All right, Steve. So thanks so much for joining us here in the 2SER studios. Pleasure to have you talking to us this morning.
Great to be here, Mitch. Thank you.
So take us back. Before Grace came out and stunned so many different people, tell us about seeing Jeff Buckley play very early on before you started actually working with him.
I first heard about Jeff probably in 1991. I was working with a group from California named Fishbone. And the keyboard player, singer, co-songwriter, Chris Dowd, comes to New York at one point and says, "Dude, you got to hear this cassette." And he brings a cassette with him of him and his roommates in their living room, just a little beatbox recorder of Led Zeppelin songs. And I go, "Wow, that guy can sing. Who's that?" He goes, "Oh, that's Hefe. That's my roommate, Jeff." So I discover there's a Jeff Buckley, and he can sing fantastically. Not looking, as an A&R guy for Columbia Records at the time, not looking for a Led Zeppelin cover band. I thought, this is good. This guy can really sing. That's nice. About 6 months later, sometime in late 91 or so, New York producer Hal Willner, who I had been working on a Charles Mingus tribute record called Weird Nightmare, Meditations at Midnight, Charles Mingus. He was going to do a tribute to Tim Buckley in Brooklyn at St. Anne's Church. And he called just to ask me if he could, Steve, do you have any Tim Buckley records? And I went, yeah, actually, I have all the Tim Buckley records. And he needed to borrow some of them for the songs to give to the other artists playing on the tribute. So I loaned him the records, got my records back, I'm happy to say. And he then called me a few days before, as that we had continued to work on this Mingus record, and said, "Hey, Buckley's kid is coming from California." I said, "Oh, I've heard him. Yeah, I'm busy that night. I can't make it." And then the concert happened, and I heard, and you can read about the results of that concert and how people were amazed of this guy lit from behind with the same kind of shaped hair, and this voice rises up, and people were gasping because it was really as if Tim Buckley was there, which again is another coincidence, as that Jeff didn't know his father very well. And he probably went through a lot just to go there to participate in it.
Of course, yeah.
So I heard how great it was, and he goes back to California. A number of months later, I'm still working on this Mingus record with Hal Willner, and we're walking through the East Village of New York City on St. Mark's Place, and there's a little club there now called Chenet, and he goes, "Oh, Buckley's kid is in New York now. He plays there." That night we went in sometime in early 1992, to see him, and there were four or five people and a little guy in the corner playing, and it was stunning from the moment that we walked in and heard him and heard how he played and the beautiful voice and the arrangements and the dynamics and especially the chordal inversions, which kind of pre-told you of band arrangement and orchestra arrangement and strings and a fully formed dynamic and musical idea.
And so this release is coming out in mid to early March. It's called You and I. What does this material consist of? It actually was recorded before the Grace album.
Yeah, you know, I think an important thing to note about this, and a truthful one, is that in Jeff's short period of time of recording for Columbia Records, there's really four periods to that. And you know the second, third, and fourth period, which is the Live at Chenet, is number two. Grace would be number three, the only full album that Jeff completed. And then the album Sketches for My Sweetheart the Drunk is number four. These tapes would be the first step in that, because this is the first thing that he recorded that we worked on together in New York City for Columbia Records. And he signed with the label. We were lucky to sign Jeff in October or so, in the fall of 1992. And come the beginning of 93, the record company is starting to say to me, "All right, we have this investment here. We've put this money in. What's he going to do?" Now, the interesting thing is Jeff was signed in a highly unusual manner, because he did not have many original songs and he didn't have a demo tape. It took him this point in his life. He was already good. It's not like I discovered him and he was good. He was already really good and tremendously talented before he got to New York and then playing there. He came to New York to decide what to do. He came to New York to go through what thousands of other artists have done over the last 50, 60, 70 years. Writers, poets, jazz musicians, punk rockers, actors, actresses, film people, camera people who came to the East Village of New York to see what, let me try to get into this. So in the winter of the beginning of 1993, I'm getting pressure from my boss at Columbia Records. So what are we going to do? Jeff was so talented that for any decision he made, he probably had to leave two or three things behind because he could play Broadway and Zeppelin and reggae and Qawwali music. He was so diverse. And he needed to have the space and time to develop of what a first Jeff Buckley record was going to be. So I suggested to him, let's go to the studio and we'll record for a day and just record everything you got, everything you know, everything you feel like, and perhaps you create a table of contents and then maybe there's one or two things there that you decide you want to start to make the album with. We went into Shelter Island Studios in New York City with the great engineer producer Steve Adabo, who at the time had been working with Suzanne Vega and Sean Colvin and Eric Anderson and many other singer-songwriters, and thought that Steve's also an excellent musician, and Jeff didn't actually own a guitar in New York City. He had borrowed guitars. And Steve had a lot of guitars, that there would be a seamless way for Jeff to go in and feel comfortable and play a lot of stuff with a great engineer who was natural, and it would kind of start to flow and just be easy. We needed to break the ice. Jeff needed to break the ice of fearing what he was going to make and fearing what the record company might do to him, the big CBS Sony machine. Mm. Not that CBS Sony was going to do anything to him. They were tremendously supportive and believed in him and became fans as well across promo, sales, chairman of the company, rest of the A&R staff. So we went in on the first day in February of 93, and Jeff was a little tense. He played about a dozen or so songs that he had on a list. Said, well, okay, well, you know, that's it. And I just go, no, that's not it. You know every song ever written. We could keep going. He goes, yeah, well, I don't know. And he was still tense and the ice hadn't broken. And I said, so, you know any Isley Brothers songs? Yeah, I don't know about Isley Brothers songs. What about Curtis Mayfield? He goes, yeah, Everyday People. I mean, People Get Ready, Move On Up. I don't know. So what about Sly? And he starts to go, ding, bam, bam, ding, doo, doo, doo. And he went, yeah, okay. So he plays Everyday People, a song that I don't know I've ever heard him play before, and I had probably seen him play 40 or 50 times already at various clubs around New York City. But he did have the ability to do that, to think of it, ingest it into his mind and body, and then it would emit out of him, and it would become Buckleyized, and it would sound like him. The second song on the album, You and I, is that version of Everyday People that we recorded on that first day, direct to two-track, no other mixing, no other effects. And that sort of broke the ice right there because he closed his eyes and he threw his head back and opened his chest out and opened that voice up, as you can hear in Everyday People on the album. And then I think he started to have a good time because we stayed there for several more days and he recorded many songs. And the album, You and I, by Jeff Buckley, is 10 songs. Two of them actually come from the Grace sessions, the first song and the 10th song. Songs 2 through 9 come from these days with Jeff and myself and Steve Adabo at the studio in New York City.
And obviously, cover songs and, you know, interpreting songs in different ways is part of every artist's repertoire. But why do you think Buckley was able to deliver them so differently and give them such a different sort of version, different sort of life almost?
It's a diverse answer because he was an incredible mimic, both musically and comedically and acting and voices, almost Robin Williams, Jim Carrey. I mean, he could be unbelievable. But on the other hand, playing to him was some kind of musical, artistic, and spiritual release. And it wasn't just playing the song and copying the song. He didn't copy anybody. He could, and there were parts of things he used and effects. But Jeff would take the song into himself, ingest it into his body, feel the song, and then it would kind of emit back out of his body. He used to call Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan his Elvis. And it was all about a spiritual delivery, and it was all about a mood and a groove and how you get to the main point of what it is you want to talk about. So he felt very seriously about the lyrics. And then rather than play at you, what he would do is gather you in, whether it was just you and I in the studio with him or it was 15,000 people at a festival. He wanted to gather you into what he did, and it was a very personal and a real delivery. And when you hear the songs and the recordings on this record and on all the records, they feel really personal. Well, that's because they were. Mm. And that's what would happen. And he would ingest these songs and Buckleyize them, and they would come out like him.
And where do you think Jeff Buckley was going to take his music, considering his obvious huge amount of talent? Where do you think he could have been or could have gone?
Well, I'll make it a briefer question than you're asking, because I think that these sessions that we did in February of 93 led towards a confidence that helped him to record what became Live at Chennai, which led him towards ending up with Musicians to Have a Band, which led to the making of Grace, which led to a very popular record that came out in Australia, more so than anywhere in the world, and a great, beautiful album, and unfortunately, the only complete album that he finished. If you listen to the sketches for My Sweetheart the Drunk, you tell a little bit of a direction that he was headed in. But when he made Grace, three quarters of it was improvised on the spot. No one knew going in making Grace that the record we were going to make would sound like the record that came out. We all thought it was going to be a guy playing the guitar and singing and a very good bass player and drummer playing with him. But they did much more than that. It developed into a full production, you know, Queen, Rush, the Beatles-sized production, which is what I thought I heard the moment I first heard him in that little club in the East Village. Where he would have gone, further beyond, I couldn't possibly tell you. I wish I could.
And just one last question, Steve. Is there anything else left in the vaults from Buckley, any other recordings that may see the light of day sometime in the future?
I can't tell you. That's really up to his mom, Mary Guibert. I want to say that though Steve Adabo and I recorded these songs in 1993, this album was compiled and produced for release by his mother, Mary Guibert, and a producer, A&R guy at Legacy Sony now, Darren Salmeri. What goes on in the future will be partially up to them. I think that anytime any artist does more than three or four recording sessions and plays some live gigs during the cassette tape era, there's always more. So I can't tell you yes, I can't tell you no. I sure hope so.
Well, Steve, it's been a blast talking to you. Thanks so much for joining us on 2SER.
Thanks. Great to be here. Thank you.